Our reading this morning is from the book of, or the Gospel according to Mark. And I'm reading chapter 5. I thought I'd, because of the content of my sermon, I thought I'd just read the whole chapter. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when he had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man out of the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. He lived among the tombs, and no one could restrain him anymore, even with a chain. For he had often been restrained with shackles and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart and the shackles he broke in pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed down before him, and he shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he had said to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." He begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now there on the hillside a great herd of swine was feeding, and the unclean spirits begged him, "Send us into the swine, let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the swine, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The swineherds ran off and told it in the city and in the country. Then people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and saw the demoniac sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had the legion, and they were afraid. Those who had seen what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine reported it. Then they began to beg Jesus to leave their neighborhood. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by demons begged him that he might be with him. But Jesus refused and said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So he went with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had. And she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. For she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he entered it, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child isn't dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. And he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. Amen. Last time we met over the Gospels, we considered the Gospel according to Mark as a liturgy paralleling the Hebrew liturgy. Before that, we considered the fact that quite a lot of Mark's Gospel had to do with conflict. Conflict between Jesus and those who had authority, but also conflict between Jesus and his nuclear family. And the fact that they didn't always seem to understand what Jesus was about. We then looked at some miracles and asked the question, what did they mean? And we considered the miracle of Jesus calming the sea and paralleling it with what we see in the beginning of Genesis. And so this morning we're going to begin with an exorcism. And before you begin worrying that I'm going to perform an exorcism, it's the one in the Gospel of Mark, which we've just read about, the exorcism of Legion. It's a story that immediately follows Jesus calming the sea. And this is no coincidence. In Marcus Borg's words, it's not a separate topic, but organically related to the preceding story. And so, when we consider the story, what do we see? And when we've considered what we've seen, we then ask, well, what does it mean? Jesus and his disciples cross the sea to the country of the Gerasenes, we are told. There they find a man who has an unclean spirit. He lives among the tombs and displays features that are common in stories of possession and exorcism. He's very strong and he can break chains. He has more than human knowledge. He knows that Jesus is the Son of the Most High God, even though Mark is normally quiet about these things. And Jesus asked the demon what his name is, and we are told it is Legion. And Legion begs Jesus to cast him into a herd of swine nearby, and this he does, and the herd of swine rush down a steep bank into the sea and are drowned. Can't imagine the farmer must have been too thrilled about that. Anyway, when the people came out to see what had happened, they found Jesus and the demoniac sitting there, and he was in his right mind. And they begged Jesus to leave them, but the man who had been cured, unsurprisingly, wanted him to stay. Instead, Jesus told him to go to his friends and to tell them what had happened, and the man went off into the Decapolis to tell of what Jesus had done for him, and everyone, we are told, was amazed. Taken at face value, Jesus heals a man. But when we start to dig, we begin to see that this story is far more than a simple healing or miracle. It's a story that highlights a massively important theme in the life of Jesus and the lives of the people. That important theme being purity and its opposite, impurity. As Marcus Borg writes, within Jewish law and practice, these opposites apply to persons, places, and things, and they ran through almost every part of the people's lives. Now, importantly, impurity wasn't a sin. Some things that were unavoidable, like menstruation, for example, created a temporary condition of impurity, but it wasn't sinful. So too did touching a corpse, think the Good Samaritan or the burial of corpses. And although impurity wasn't sinful, it was considered contagious and it had great power. By the time the story appears in Mark, he had already introduced the theme. Jesus touching an unclean leper, Jesus teaching with unclean people, and being accused of being possessed himself. But here, Mark goes into great detail and he raises 5 points that we need to take note of. And those 5 points are the following. Firstly, geography. Jesus and his disciples cross the sea, and where do they end up? They end up in Gentile territory. And Gentile territory was considered impure. Secondly, possession. The demoniac is possessed by an unclean spirit. Thirdly, proximity to corpses. The man had lived among the tombs on ground defiled by the presence of corpses. In the time of Jesus, even stepping on a grave made a person unclean. Fourthly, name. The name of the demoniac is Legion. And what was Legion? It was a Roman military unit, like a modern-day division. And Legion was the pagan and impure imperial power that controlled the land. The man and the land then were possessed by Legion. And finally, animals, lots of them. And they were pigs, unclean animals according to the Jews. Amidst the chaos of this scene of overwhelming impurity, Jesus exercised Legion and sent the unclean spirits into the pigs who rushed into the sea and drowned. What does this teach us? That Jesus overcomes impurity. That although impurity is contagious, the power of the Spirit of Jesus is stronger than impurity. Instead of Jesus becoming impure, he cleanses the impurity by his touch and also with his words. But there could be more that has to do with the name Legion. Could this story also be an allusion to the Roman Empire and about the expulsion of Roman imperial power? Not through violent means, but through the proclamation of the gospel of the kingdom of God. An alternative to the kingdoms and the empires of this world. And that has to teach us about our world too, and how we understand it. Jesus then does things that he wasn't supposed to do because the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And the author of Mark continues with the theme of impurity, and he uses what is sometimes called the sandwich technique. That is, he tells the story of the synagogue leader's 12-year-old daughter, intersperses it with the story of the woman who had bled for 12 years, and then he resumes with the conclusion of the story about Jairus, the synagogue leader's daughter. And this was a technique favored by Mark. Why? Because it encouraged his readers to interpret the story considering all the ingredients that made up that wonderful sandwich. So when you think of the story, you can think of your favorite sandwich. And three things arise from these stories: purity and impurity, the importance of stories about women in the Gospels, and lastly, the importance of faith. The woman's constant flow of blood, like menstruation, would have made her unclean, and we are told she endured the condition for 12 years. Think about it. It was the possibility that she hadn't had any human contact for 12 years, just like the man who lived among the tombs. And we know that no human contact is devastating for us as human beings, even those of us who like to be on their own. We need contact with people. We need to be touched. Furthermore, it was believed that impurity, as I've said, was contagious. In other words, when the woman touched his garment, Jesus should have been made impure. But what do we witness? Well, we witness exactly the reverse. The impurity is overcome because of her contact with Jesus. Again, Jesus banishes her impurity and he makes her whole again. And out of all the gospel authors, Luke emphasizes woman the most. But Mark focuses on woman too. For example, in the first chapter, Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law. Then he healed a woman we've considered, and Jairus' daughter, and the daughter of a Gentile woman. In the last week of his life, he was anointed for burial by a woman. And women, not any of his male companions or disciples who had all fled, witnessed his crucifixion and were the first to be told of his resurrection. And these were massively important things, and the fact that the stories about them actually survived in a hugely patriarchal society is nothing more than miraculous, and we have to take note. And finally, Jesus said to the woman, "Daughter, your faith has made you well." And so we ask the question, well, what was her faith? It was her belief, her conviction, that Jesus could make her well and restore her to her community and also to her loved ones. In other words, her faith wasn't belief in a set of doctrines. Her faith was confidence in Jesus. The woman's faith then contrasts brilliantly with the fear of the disciples on the boat in the stormy sea. "Why are you afraid?" Jesus asked them. "Have you still no faith?" he said to them. In other words, put your trust in me. What about the other parts of the sandwich? The 12-year-old daughter of Jairus, a synagogue leader. Take note, firstly, if you're into numbers and things, that the number 12 appears in both stories. 12 years old, 12 years of blood flow. Jairus was a leader of the synagogue, we are told. But what does this actually mean? Well, in first century Galilee, a synagogue was an assembly. It was a gathering. It wasn't necessarily a building. And Jairus was the leader of a local Jewish synagogue. He thus probably wasn't one of the ruling elite. Jairus tells Jesus that his daughter is near death and begs Jesus to go and lay his hands on her to heal her. The journey, however, gets interrupted by the woman who bled, and messengers then report that Jairus' daughter had died in the interim. And Jesus says to Jairus, "Do not fear, only believe." Fear and its opposite, faith. Themes from the stilling of the storm to the healing of the woman with the flow of blood. Now they arrive at Jairus' house, and as you can imagine, there's a huge commotion. Mourners grieving the daughter's death. And Jesus asks them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child isn't dead, but sleeping." And the crowd laughs at him. I thought if they were British, they might have shouted "Nutter" or something like that. But Jesus takes the daughter by the hand and says to a little girl, "Get up." And the little girl gets up. Now we could ask questions about the "not dead but sleeping" bit. Like, what exactly did Jesus mean? Was the girl in a coma, or did Jesus raise her, making the first person to be raised from the dead by Jesus? But to ask these questions, as valid and interesting as they might be, is to actually miss Mark's point. The story is the last in a series of miracles that Jesus performed. Miracles where the common thread was what? Close. Impurity. So it makes sense then that this is what we should consider, remembering that a story is part of a sandwich, so to speak. The young girl was dead. She wasn't supposed to be touched because she was impure. Yet Jesus touched her and restored her to life, just like he restored the demoniac and just like he restored the woman who bled for 12 years. He healed what was broken in them. And Jesus had power. He had power over the forces that stood against God. Power over the sea and evil spirits. Power over legion. Power over impurity. And it seems power over death. He had the power then to awaken people to new life. And this is what Jesus did. Not just individuals, but also the entire land. And that is what the author of Mark wanted his readers to see and understand. By the end of chapter 5, then, the author of Mark has introduced the central themes of his gospel, themes that will pop up again in the course of the gospel, and then we enter into a new section all the time, getting closer and closer to the journey section of Mark, of Jesus and his disciples, the journey from Galilee to Jerusalem. Now, I want to save the next part, chapter 6 to 8, for next time. But I want to end by thinking about what we've considered today and asking ourselves the question, what might all of this actually mean for us? You see, every now and then we might hear of near escapes and out of the ordinary things happening in people's lives, but I think we have to say they certainly aren't the norm. And sometimes people say, well, the reason why we don't see such things nowadays is because people don't have enough faith. But friends, I don't believe this is true. I do not believe the faith that we witness in people in the Bible is somehow superior to the faith that we witness in people today. In fact, I think it might even be stronger, considering firstly the kind of world that we live in, and secondly the fact that we cannot see Jesus in any physical kind of way with our own eyes, and yet we still follow him. Plus the fact that I don't believe the miracles are the point of the story, that they were never meant to eclipse the point. Instead, they are a vehicle or a channel, if you like, for the real point. And that is that Jesus is the one who brings healing and wholeness. Jesus is the one who makes the crooked things straight. Jesus is the one who makes the broken whole again. He has the authority. He has the power. He has the love coursing through his veins to bless those considered dirty, impure, marked by others as untouchable. He turns the tables. He turns the well-worn traditions on their heads. And what did experiencing wholeness require of those whom Jesus encountered? What does it require of us? What does Jesus long to see? Simple trust and simple faith. I believe then that the miracle Jesus brings us is the possibility of transformation and the tools Jesus gives us to overcome great challenges. Now, we might not miraculously regrow a missing limb or miraculously be cured of some sickness or illness, but Jesus gives us the strength and the courage we need and the presence of the love of God to deal with all the challenges we face. Finally, we are taught not to blindly follow the rest of society. Not to judge and condemn and call what is ultimately of God impure. In other words, in this, our calling in and through the example of Jesus is to love God and to love our neighbors as we love ourselves. Amen.